Okay, Zechariah chapter 9. As we go through this very detailed book, really, that is a prophecy, a sermon, and a lot of prophecy. It's been 15, 16 years, something around then, that they have been back in the land of Judah and Jerusalem and have occupied their homes for a while, started the temple, but have had trouble finishing it. So some of this encouragement is because of that need to finish the temple that they started, as well as just encouraging them and building them up in their faith and in their dedication, because it's not going to be an easy road this next few hundred years until the Messiah comes. There's a lot of trouble that's going to be coming along. In fact, this chapter in Zechariah describes what I believe is a very specific event that happens over a few years, actually, but it's, as far as in time goes, it's about 180 years from now. We're going to have somebody show up on the scene who comes along, basically, and this is Alexander the Great, and he comes along as the head of the Grecian Empire and overthrows the Media-Persian Empire. If you remember, keep these empires straight, the 70-year captivity, Israel served in the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar took them away. And then after 70 years, God raised up his servant Cyrus, who was part of the rulership of Persia, overthrew the Babylonians, freed Israel to return to their land. And now we've got, we're in that particular context of history, back in the history book of Ezra. We've taken a break because God sends these two prophets. But here's a prediction, here's a prophecy of what I believe is very clearly, even though names aren't mentioned, other than the nation of Greece we'll see is mentioned here, of something that happens about 180, 190 years down the road, where Alexander the Great, I was thinking Cyrus, no, Alexander the Great, king of the Greeks, comes and overthrows the nation of Persia and just about every other nation in the world of the time, except Judah, except for Israel. He leaves them alone. He comes down, and he as you will see through this context, he just takes over every nation coming down through, even down to Egypt. History records he goes down there. He's actually received very kind of warmly by Egypt, because they just no way they could stand up to this empire of the Greeks, and they welcome him as a ruler. He becomes basically a pharaoh, honorary pharaoh down there in Egypt, builds the city of Alexandria, which you probably heard of before, but he just overthrows every kingdom except for Judah. And this prediction is given to the Israelites some 180 years before this happens, so they can know, those who are living during that time when it actually happens, and for those of us who live now who can look back and read this, to see that God's in control of the kingdoms of men. No worries. Don't be worried about what's going on in the world. God's in charge. He'll lift up the kingdoms when it's time. He tears them down when it's time. So let's read through the first 8 or 9 verses of this, and we'll go back and kind of pick it apart a bit, get some of the detail. But here we have chapter 9, verse 1. The burden of the word of the Lord is against the land of Hadrach, with Damascus as its resting place. For the eyes of men, especially of all the tribes of Israel, are toward the Lord. And Hamath also, which borders on it, Tyre and Sidon, though they are very wise. For Tyre built herself a fortress and piled up silver like dust and gold like the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will dispossess her and cast her wealth into the sea, and she will be consumed with fire. Ashkelon will see it and be afraid. Gaza, too, will writhe in great pain. Also Ekron, for her expectation has been confounded. Moreover, the king will perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon will not be inhabited. And a Mongol race will dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. And I will remove their blood from their mouth and their detestable things from between their teeth. Then they also will be a remnant for our God and will be like a clan in Judah, and Ekron like a Jebusite. But I will camp around my house because of an army, because of him who passes by and returns. And no oppressor will pass over them anymore, for now I have seen with my eyes. Okay, a lot happening in those first, in those verses here. And let's just look and see what happens. If I'm correct, which everybody that I've read is talking about this, it must apply to this period of time, about 180 years down in the future, where Alexander, King Alexander, overthrows the Medes and Persians and comes down from the north here into Syria and Samaria and Judea and down into Egypt, and he just overthrows one nation after another. And he comes down to Egypt, and then he comes back and back up, and then goes over to India and starts a big campaign over there. And at the age of 30, I think he gets killed. So he does all this, you know, before the age of 30, as this, you know, great warring king of Greece. So he comes down here. Let's just look at some of these names, so we can kind of figure out where we are. Damascus, of course, is up here in Syria. That's right there. Up in this nation. Hadrach and Hamath are not as clear. They're not on this map, but they're up a little bit further north. They're parts of Syria as well. Comes down through here, hits Damascus, Sidon, Tyre, comes down through here. We have down here Gaza. I can't even read it from here. How can you possibly read it from there? Anyway, Gaza and Ashkelon and Ashdod and Ekron, all these cities down here, he just takes them over one by one. Then he goes down to Egypt, like I say, and says, okay, give up or I'm going to just wipe you out. And they give up and they say, come on in, Pharaoh. And not tough to be a Pharaoh if you got enough strength and army, you see. We'll just make you a Pharaoh, you know, and you'll be one of our eternal, well, they already thought he was an eternal being anyway because of what he had accomplished. But then he comes back up through, takes care of some other cities, not mentioned here, on his way back up over to India. But Judah, he leaves alone. Why? You know, this is amazing, kind of this thing. And a little bit of history that may or may not be true. Mostly, actually, some of the details, of course, are just tradition. But we'll talk about that when we get to that point down here in verse 8. But let's see here. Hadrach, Hamath, Tyre. Here's a couple slides. If you remember the history of Tyre, this is this seafaring nation down the coast of, well, we just pointed out there, and they had a city on the land, and we're not going to go into much detail. We could spend two or three classes on the details, but they had a large city on the land, but they moved most of their fortresses and their town out to this island. That was, it was about 1,000 yards offshore. But hey, 1,000 yards is 1,000 yards. I mean, that's far enough along where you can't jump from one to the other. And they were indefeatable. Babylon, they tried to come up against them, and they gave up. Nebuchadnezzar couldn't defeat them. But God sent Alexander the Great down here, and through a number of campaigns, both on the water and when he discovered that it was taking too long to defeat them with his navy, he decided, if you remember the story, to throw a bunch of the building materials from here on land out into the sea, and he made a causeway out to the city, and basically came up against this indestructible island with this causeway. And reading different historical accounts, they would do a whole bunch of different things. They built these embattlements on the end of the causeway. And finally, with the combination of this and their navy, they overthrew them. So that's a very colorful story. But the point is, as you read the context here, you see how God basically is showing some disdain for this city, who thought that they were undefeatable. They had all this money. Tyre and Sidon, though they are very wise, I mean, it's a pretty smart thing to build your town out on this island where nobody could get you. That's a pretty good idea. Build yourself a fortress, piled up silver like dust, gold like the mire of the streets. You got enough gold and silver, you can buy some nations back at this time, smaller ones, and they had a lot. But what did Alexander the Great care? He had much, much more. And his plans, you know, who knows who gives these great leaders their plans, but just as God apparently gave Cyrus the plan to sneak under the walls of Babylon by diverting the water, remember, so many years ago, before this, then perhaps God gave Alexander the plan to build this causeway out from the shore. But even though they had all the gold, all the dust, verse 4, behold, the Lord will dispossess her and cast her wealth into the sea, and she will be consumed with fire. And Alexander, like he did a lot of the cities that if you gave up, if you were to give up like Egypt did, and some of the cities did, he'd leave you alone. He would set up his own ruler in your town, and you just business as usual kind of thing, except, of course, there are more taxes. There's always more taxes, you know. And so you'd pay taxes, but Alexander wasn't that way. Let me say this. A lot of the people that over to like Babylon wouldn't even take the governor out of the town. They would use the same governor if he was okay. But Alexander usually dispossessed the king and put his own emissary in charge. And he'd make an example of the king. But if you didn't resist, he wouldn't destroy your town. If you did, he'd burn you. He'd just burn you right down to the ground. And that's what they did to Tyre, just burned it down. And basically, the people that didn't escape just put them all to the sword. So a lot of these Phoenicians, these are all Phoenicians here along the coast, were destroyed, and so many of them were scattered. But lots of details there, I said, like you can get into in the history that's pretty interesting. Tracy.
If you're sitting on the island, you think you're so safe, you're watching us.
I know. I've thought about that.
And it would take a long time. That would be a great, you know,
yeah.
After rebuilding, you'd be watching, oh, we're still safe, and it's halfway there, and then pretty soon you're like, oh.
Well, and it's like this, and I forget the passage, and I didn't want to spend too much time on this, but that's great, is they use the building materials of the old city, but when that proved insufficient, I don't know what the scripture is because I haven't looked it up recently, but they began to scrape the dust of the ground, Ezekiel, and pile that up. So you could just imagine when they ran out of it, they go, oh, they only got halfway here. Nah, 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 nah. You know, you can't make. Well, then they start digging up the dirt and excavating the ground and starting to start to pour it out there. So, that would be an amazing thing to see that coming at you. Mike, you had a comment?
No.
So that's just, they're just one of the cities that Alexander takes over. Let's look at a couple other details here. The king will perish from Gaza. And again, that's typical for Alexandra. He would take the kings and put his own king in. Other great rulers like the Medes and Persians and the Babylonians wouldn't do that. But Alexander, that was the way he did it. So God just foretells that habit of his in that one statement. Ashkelon will not be inhabited. It says here, I think, in verse 5. And it wasn't that there was never going to be anybody living in Ashkelon again, but the Philistines wouldn't live there anymore. That's the point, I believe, is being made. And the Philistines basically kind of disappeared off the face of the ground. We'll see that in just a minute. They no longer are a nation of the Philistines with these towns. They become a muddled mess of mixed races after this. And some of them, we'll see in a bit, even become part of Judah. So, loosely speaking. So, he takes away their nationality is what happens. Verse 6 here, a mongrel race will dwell in Ashdod, or maybe some say a bastard, but that's simply meaning children that didn't belong to the Philistines. And I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. That word is used a lot in the Old Testament, nations that are being overthrown. I will cut off their pride. And usually what that refers to is their nationality. The pride of being a nation is no longer there. It's going to happen to Judah here in the time of Christ. That whole nation is going to be cut off from being God's chosen people. But usually what it's talking about when they cut off the pride is that it's just basically going to be doing away with the nation and their nationality. They're no longer going to have a government that's a king. They're no longer going to have a recognition as being a great nation. That's what I've been able to find out about what that word pride means. It's been used a few times in Zechariah before about other nations that God dealt with. So we'll cut off the pride of the Philistines. Let me see if I'm missing anything here. I will remove their blood from their mouth and their detestable things from between their teeth. This is verse 7. Then they also will be a remnant for God and be like a clan in Judah. Now that's interesting. So he basically is saying they're no longer going to be idolaters. I think is what that first part of that passage is. They're no longer going to be eating these sacrifices to idols. And you see this happens, the same with Judah. As Judah no longer had a problem with idolatry. Well, these nations, the Philistines, no longer were involved in idolatry when you come down to the time of Christ. In fact, what happened to some of them, it says here, they will also be a remnant for our God and become like a clan in Judah. So it's almost like they're a sub-tribe in Judah. Judah sort of absorbs them. Now, I don't know if they actually became recognized as Jews. I doubt that, but they were just a part of them. And there's an example that's given here that happened earlier in Old Testament history. And Ekron will be like a Jebusite. We can read back about what this must be referring to back in Joshua 15, verse 63. This is when, as they are taking over the different nations in the Promised Land and overthrowing different cities and small countries. Not so with the Jebusites. It says here in verse 63 of chapter 15 in Joshua, "Now as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah could not drive them out. So the Jebusites lived with the sons of Judah at Jerusalem until this day." So that's what happened to the Jebusites. And that's what's going to happen to a lot of these Philistines, is that they're no longer going to have their own national pride, separate nation anymore. It's not going to be Judah and Philistine on the coast. It's going to be, yeah, these are some people that were just live now with the Jews, along with them. And again, that's basically what happens to a lot of these tribes. They're absorbed into Judah or Samaria or these other nations along that were that bordered them. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the Philistines were the ocean-going people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, commerce. Commerce was a huge thing with them. Of course, things had to, if you wanted to ship something somewhere, you had to go through one of those towns. Yep.
So they were a relative, I mean, they were a strong economic, center in that area.
Yes.
And it would be difficult, for the average person to imagine. It would be like saying, well, one of these days, Seattle's going to be, wiped off the map, and
right.
People won't dwell there anymore.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, too. So what happens when Alexander destroys the Tyrrhenians and the Sidonians and these other towns? How do you get your product that you over to? Because these guys, they were very advanced. I mean, their ships were old ships, but they had very extensive systems of shipping and commerce back at this time. It had been Prussia. To see what they could actually do. And so when all that's kind of is taken out by Alexander, to that extent, I'm not sure exactly how they did their business. Other people came in, opportunity for some entrepreneur to start up his own shipping company, I guess, when Tyre goes down. Did you have your hand up there, Andrew?
When Alexander the Great took Sidon, he actually didn't destroy Sidon. You talk about Alexander's Navy, mm-hmm. That's where he got his name. There were a group of city-states that the Phoenicians actually ruled, Byblos and Tyre and Sidon, and Carthage. Carthage wasn't destroyed by Alexander the Great, so the Phoenicians actually never completely were wiped out. So the Romans took care of Carthage, but there were still people trading and ships sailing.
So there's still seaports. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Any other comment on that? Okay, so let's see here. Verse 8, this is the part that really is impressive. "But I will camp around my house because of an army, because of him who passes by and returns, and no oppressor will pass over them anymore." So again, very obviously it must be an allusion to Alexander who goes by, let's back up here. He comes by them twice, coming down from the north, passing down, destroying some cities, coming back this way, passes them by twice, and does not come in and even threaten the Judeans. I mean, they basically, I guess, are a people that they weren't offering any kind of resistance either, but he leaves them alone, is basically what history says. And the tradition says that Alexander comes into Judah, and the high priest welcomes him into the city. Now, whether this is true or not, this is Josephus, who's an historian, that most of what he writes seems to be credible. And the high priest at the time basically takes him and shows him a prophecy that was in Daniel that predicts that he would be the ruler, not by name, but that Greece would be the ruler, and there would be a great king in charge. And so when Alexander reads this prophecy, plus Josephus says he also had a vision or a dream that says, leave these guys alone. Again, that's Josephus. That's not in the Bible. And he leaves them alone. He sees this, let's go ahead and read what Daniel says back in Daniel 8. We'll just read a few verses here out of the context. This is the vision of the great statue of gold and bronze and silver and iron mixed with mud. And he was the, I'm trying to remember. He's the third in line. He's the bronze one. He's the legs of bronze, I think, or the middle of bronze. Let's go see. I can't remember. But he's the... Okay, Daniel 8. What'd you say? Daniel 7? Pardon? Okay, when I say Daniel 8. Okay. Oh, well, maybe that's the one I'm looking at then. All right, this is where he's actually mentioned specifically. So it's the vision of the ram in Daniel 8. That's what I mean. Let's go back and look at that. Daniel 8, verse 19. Okay. Let's see if I am right where I am. Maybe I'm looking. Let's see. He said, "Behold, I am going to let you." Did I quote this wrong? Right. Just let me go back and get this catch. Let's just read that context there. Got to get to the right book now. Hold on a minute. Yeah, okay. Just want to get the right context here. Okay, I just picked out the verse that was the application part, so hold on. Right. Okay, let's look at the vision first, just quickly. Daniel 8, Daniel, did you say Daniel 8, verse 4?
3, 5, 4, 5, 5.
Yeah, okay. So verse 5, while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. The goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes, and he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So I hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Okay, I don't want to read that whole context. Let's go down to the application in verses 19 beginning. And this is his interpretation. He said, behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia, and the shaggy goats represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king, and that would be Alexander. And the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent the kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. And that's talking about Alexander after his rule. His nation is divided up between the four four armies, I believe. There are four generals. one of them being the Seleucids, which we'll talk about in a bit. Excuse me. Okay, just a minute there. Little frog there. Good old allergies, you know, you love allergies. Okay, this is the prophecy that was by tradition shown to Alexander, and he, whether that really happened, the point is God spared them. And God did not come in and overthrow them. He let them continue under their jurisdiction, under Greece's jurisdiction, but did not conquer them, did not fight or have a battle there. And so that was something that's amazingly fulfilled, where the nations around him were falling left and right around the Jews. Okay. Yeah. Who's got his hand up? Bill.
Alexander the Great was so smitten by the Jews and by the Greeks and what they did for him, mm-hmm, that he set aside a certain portion of Alexandria, his own city, to celebrate the Jews, their architecture, their literature.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And whether that was because of he saw this prophecy or he had that vision, again, those are things that are just secular history, not something that's contained in the Bible. What we do see is that God was going to spare them. He predicted that he would spare them, and he did, as he came through and conquered basically the rest of the world. Okay. Any more comments up through verse 8? Let's get back down to where we were there, which I don't know if it makes a difference, because I think, yeah, we'll leave that one for a minute here. That's the next chapter. Okay, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble, and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Okay, here's one of those messianic prophecies pointing up to Christ. As we look into Zechariah, what we'll have is we'll have things that the prophet is talking about that are current. Sometimes they're things that happen 150, 160 years later, like with Alexander, and sometimes it jumps right up to when his deliverer, the Messiah, comes. And this is a statement being made, of course, about that Messiah. Let's read those passages as they're fulfilled in the New Testament. And let me see here. Matthew 21, verse 1 through 8. Come over here to Mike. Could you read, Mike Franklin? Matthew 21, verses 1 through 8. And we'll see where this is. Matthew takes this as applying to Jesus Christ, that this was a prediction, a prophecy concerning him.
Then Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go into the village in front of you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, you will say the Lord needs them, and he will send them at once." This took place to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, saying, "Say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden." The disciples went and did as Jesus had directed them. They brought the donkey and the colt and put on them their cloaks, and he sat on them. Most of the crowd spread their cloaks on the road, and others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road.
Okay. Now, what's unusual about that prophecy, other than the fact that Jesus fulfilled it? What's unusual about this being a king coming in to take his kingdom? Yeah, how does a king normally come in? How did Alexander, a picture of Alexander, what's he riding? And this is just a picture, but yeah, I mean, he's got this big war horse or his chariot, and he's got all these guys on horses and chariots and bows and arrows. How did Jesus come into his kingdom? On the foal of a donkey. That's what was predicted. And I don't know what they would have thought back here when they thought, well, our king is going to be riding on this humble. That's what the whole thing is. It's humble. There is no great power of war here where he comes in and defeats nations like Alexander or any other king did. He comes into his kingdom in a different way. And, of course, Jesus did fulfill this prophecy. But there's more to it than that. I mean, sometimes we think, well, yeah, wow, this is exactly the way it was predicted he would come in. But the underlying meaning of this is that his dominion in this earth is different than the dominion of other kings. Other kings come in and say, hey, look, give up or we'll destroy you. Okay, we'll give up. What does ISIS do over there in Iraq? How do they win the hearts of people over there as they're coming in? They put a gun to your head and they said, you're going to convert or else. That's what they do. So is that what Jesus did? Came in with a big force and said, okay, you're going to be my subject. You're going to be my subject. If not, you're dead. No. Where's his dominion? Right here in the heart. That's where it is. He gave himself on the cross. Such love that no one's ever seen. And his servants went out and preached that gospel and converted people willingly. His kingdom, his dominion, his overthrow of the entire earth was a peaceful dominion. And that's what's amazing about this prophecy. Sure, the words about the mule or the donkey or whatever, the foal of a donkey are amazing. But it's the nature of Christ coming into his kingdom and gaining his power. And let's look on the next couple of passages here. Verse 10, as he comes in on this foal of a donkey, and I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim. The chariot's a warring thing. The horse, that's, remember, always war. And the bow of war will be cut off. And he will speak peace to the nations. And his dominion will be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. So, I mean, what an amazing prophecy to be able to look and see that, okay, now the king of the Jews is coming in, defeating all the enemy, but it's a peaceful march. It's on the foal of a donkey. It's only willing people that come and join this kingdom, and its dominion will cover from sea to sea, much greater than Babylon or Medes and Persia, or here with Alexander the Great and his tremendous army, which is probably, he had probably the largest expanse territory, right, of any of the nations back in that ancient time. And yet nothing compared to what Jesus did in peace and humility. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing. And the amazing part of it right now is, as he's telling this, as Zechariah is preaching this or prophesying this, is that he's telling this 500 years before it ever happens. Which, again, was another thing the Jews, when Jesus came, could have looked and read Zechariah and said, yeah, wow, happened just like he said. He didn't come in with an army. He came in on the foal of a donkey. So, pretty impressive when you see it that way. Okay, let's see, verse 11. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I have set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to the stronghold, O prisoners, who have the hope. This very day I am declaring that I will restore double to you. So we'd return back to sort of present, at least for a bit. And he says, look, as for you, look what I've done. I've restored you from this pit. And this is language that's been used before in the Old Testament. We look over at Exodus chapter 24, verse 8. Moses uses this to describe the Israelites being freed from the Egyptian bondage. He says over there, so Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant, which is what Zechariah just said, the blood of my covenant, which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. That's not what I wanted to read. Just a second here. Verse 11. Okay, what happened to that quotation? Oh, there it is. Sorry. I'm skipping ahead just a little bit here. first Exodus 24, verse 8, talking about this blood of the covenant, which likely isn't talking about the blood that Jesus shed. It's talking about the blood which Moses took here and sprinkled on the people. That was the blood of the covenant which the Lord had made with you and according with all his words. They were in a covenant relationship, and God restored that relationship with them when he brought them out of captivity. All right, let's get back to the second part of this verse. And I have set your prisoners free from this waterless pit. Now let's look over to Psalms 40, verse 2, and we'll see similar language there about when we're in, when captivity or destruction or troubles or problems or trials come. This passage refers to that same kind of language. Psalm 40, verse 2, he brought me up also out of a horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock and established my goings. So just words of deliverance. This is what God has done for his people. Bringing them out of the Babylonian captivity and restoring their fortunes, even so much it says here, I will restore double to you. And exactly the fulfillment of that, it's not really clear because they didn't have double land. They weren't any greater physical nation. And so perhaps that partly is referring to the spiritual fulfillment of Jerusalem as it comes into the spiritual kingdom. Of course, is going to be much greater than the physical kingdom ever was. Okay, any comments up there to verse 12, I guess? All right. If not, verse 13 and 14. For I will bend Judah as my bow, and I will fill the bow with Ephraim, and I will stir up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece. And I will make you like a warrior's sword. Then the Lord will appear over them, and his arrow will go forth like lightning, and the Lord God will blow the trumpet and will march in the storm winds of the south. Okay, language at least we can say about this is that God's going to be with his people, and they're going to be, whenever they have conflicts from now on, God's going to be with them. They're not going to be taken captive. And just like here and under Alexander the Great comes as great conqueror. Judah is going to be there. They're not going to be defeated. He's going to give them what they need to be to stand and not to be conquered again, not to be brought into captivity or destroyed again. And it also probably is referring to here in another 100 years beyond that, when Alexander dies and his generals take over, and if you look at this area, it's the Seleucids that become in charge. Is that general? Oops, wrong way. Let's go back this way. This map. The general that's put in charge or takes this whole area, and it goes up north here further, and I forget how far south it goes, are the Seleucids. And the Seleucids are the ones in charge of Judea now. I mean, Judea never becomes its own independent state ever again. It never becomes its own nation without being underneath, you know, the Medes and Persians, the Greeks, or the Romans. They're always going to be a vassal under some other authority. But during this time, when there's conflicts, God's going to be with this period. And there's some historical things concerning this period of time between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament for those 400 years, where there are struggles that happen. The Maccabees are a Jewish fighting force that go and actually fight with the Seleucids, the Greeks and the Seleucids, and they don't win their freedom, but they win religious freedom. And that history is pretty impressive. So again, that's just some things that happened during this time between the Testaments. The point that's being made here is God's not going to let them be destroyed or conquered again and taken off away from their land and taken into captivity again. But he will be with them and fight for them. Andrew had his hand up.
Yeah, I actually didn't understand that under the Maccabees they do actually hold their freedom for a brief period of time.
I didn't know that. Okay, I didn't think they actually did do that. Did they?
Yeah.
For how long was that?
Oh, it might have been 60 years.
Okay. Okay, all right. Appreciate that history from one of our history majors there. Mike.
Yeah,
one thing, and it was a benevolent and a benign ignoring of them that allowed them to continue there for a time. However, the generals that came after him, in particular the Seleucids, they didn't have such a kind and benevolent attitude toward them. In fact, at one point, under Ptolemy, they came in and tried to impose their pagan worship on the Jews, and that, of course, is what prompted the Maccabean revolt.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it got very dire before it got to the point that the Maccabees accomplished their conquest.
We'll have to talk about maybe doing a little bit of, after this series of the return from captivity is finished and we finish out the Old Testament, whether we do a little bit of between the Testament history, just to bring us in, because a lot that happens between Malachi and Matthew and the Gospels. So, we'll see what happens. I may not be the best one for that one, not the greatest with the history there. We'll see what we can do there. Somebody is probably can do a good job at that. Not that I could learn it, I'm sure, but. Okay. What is said in the prophecy is that God's going to be with them. He's going to be fighting for them. He's going to be, his arrow is going to be going forth like lightning. And so he's going to be with. He's not going to allow them to be taken off into that, in a similar way that they had just returned from into that captivity. Okay. Let's see here. Verse 15, more of this kind of language, I guess, really here in verse 15. The Lord of hosts will defend them, and they will devour and trample on the sling stones, and they will drink and be boisterous as with wine, and they will be filled like a sacrificial basin, drenched like the corners of the altar. Okay, we're not going to go into every one of those figures here, but here this drinking and be boisterous. There's a similar quote just in the next couple of verses. Ephraim in Zechariah 10 verse 7 talks about Ephraim will be like a mighty man, and their heart will be glad as if from wine. So I don't think he's saying they're going to be drunkards. He's going to say that they're going to be boisterous and joyful as somebody who's drunk too much, and you can see he's laughing and hearty and everything. Not a good thing to be drunk, but it's going to look like that because of what God is doing for them, because of his deliverance. They're going to be rejoicing in their blessings. Okay, let's see. Trample on the sling stones. That's kind of an interesting thought. I looked at that and thought, what is that talking about? And did some little bit of research. There's something similar back in Job, actually. Anybody know what a sling stone is? What?
The stone you put in the sling.
That's right. David used one against Goliath. some people, I guess, tried to use them against the Leviathan. Back in Job 41 and 20 and verse 21, this is the Leviathan that's being talked about, which either is a big, huge alligator, or my favorite thing is it's a fire-breathing dragon that's since, extinct. But you can look at that passage and see, because it says it actually breathes fire back there. So make your own choice. it says here in Job 41 verse 20, the son of the bow will not make him flee. Sling stones are to him him turned into stubble. Clubs are counted as stubble. He laughs at the shaking of a spear. So whatever this Leviathan was, maybe it was a dinosaur that was still existing back then. Like I said, I think it was a fire-breathing dragon because it breathed fire. Look at that context if you're wondering. And they've since extinct. I mean, there's so much about fire-breathing dragons in our history. You think that probably they were around once upon a time. If you don't like that thing about fire-breathing dragon, then do you think there ever was a Tyrannosaurus Rex? Sure there was. They're no longer around anymore. You don't see them in the zoos, but we have skeletons of them. Maybe we'll find a skeleton of a fire-breathing dragon someday. But anyway, that's another story. There was a great beast called the Leviathan that sling stones couldn't stop. And so the connection basically is the same with you. You'll trample down on the sling stones, those adversaries and armies that come up against you. Apparently the Seleucids were more aggressive than I understood, and that God would be with them and defeat them. Okay, verse 16. And the Lord their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people, for they are the stones of a crown. They are as the stones of a crown, sparkling in his land, for what comeliness and beauty will be theirs. Grain will make the young men flourish, and new wine the virgins. So there's going to be some peaceful times here, not just going to be warring times, but God's going to bless them, let them enjoy peace, and they do have a considerable amount of peace for some time, and they enjoy that. But they also have their trials and troubles before Jesus Christ comes and the New Testament era is ushered in. Okay, a few more chapters to go yet. Any questions about chapter 9? A couple of the more actually difficult chapters coming up. Not that this one was such an easy one, but yeah, I think it must really be applying to Alexander and his campaign, the primary part of that chapter. Lee.
One of the things that we've noticed here in this time period is we have the Seleucids from the north, the Ptolemies from the south.
Right.
Both claim Palestine.
Okay.
Which meant that it became the zone in which the two nations battled each other.
Ah, all right.
And so that is a lot of what we're seeing here. Mm-hmm. It's not that the Seleucids all went ahead. They did. They tried to impose their religion upon the Jews.
Attack is epiphany. Yeah.
The Seleucids weren't so much fighting against Judah and the Israelites, the Jews there, as they were fighting against Ptolemy, the south of them. Mm-hmm. And to get through there, they had to pass through Palestine.
Through them, right.
And when the Ptolemies tried to get to the Seleucids, they had to pass through Palestine. And so it is a battle zone that not important to either nation, mm-hmm. the Seleucids or the Ptolemies, but it's where they end up doing battle.
Right. Okay. All right. Appreciate that history. And whatever the case being there, God promises he's going to be with them during that time. Mike?
I misspoke earlier.
Okay.
I said it was Ptolemy, but it was actually Antiochus Epiphanes.
Yes, Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay. Time we got here? A couple minutes. And there we end here, chapter 10. Now let's take the first couple of verses of chapter 10. And here we have God, primary point and goal and purpose of this passage, as you look through it, is that God will bless his people and give them victory. So we're going to have some similar language as we had in chapter 9. We won't spend a lot of time in that one. Chapter 11, when we get there, is going to be a little bit more detailed and interesting. But let's just take a look at the first few verses anyway of chapter 10. Starts out here, ask rain from the Lord at the time of the spring rain, and the Lord will make the storm clouds, and he will give them the showers of rain, vegetation in the field to each man. If you were to look back at Deuteronomy 11, verse 13, you could see a promise that this kind of statement would be based on. And let me just read that. Deuteronomy 11, verse 13 through 15. It shall come about, if you listen obediently to my commandments, which I am commanding you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, that he will give the rain for the land in its season, the early and the late rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and your oil. He will give grass in your fields for your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied. Going to be any different today, you think, than back there in Deuteronomy or back here in Zechariah? If we will follow the Lord, be faithful, do the best we can to serve him, God will give us our portion, and he will enjoy the blessings from his hands. So that's what he's telling him now. He says, this is what will happen. In verse 2, he says, for the teraphim speak iniquity. So don't go back to these idols. And the diviners see lying visions and tell false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore, the people wander like sheep. They are afflicted because there is no shepherd. My anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the male goats. For the Lord of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and he will make them like his majestic horse in battle. Okay, so here we have some, God has trouble with the shepherds, and we're going to see more of that in chapter 11, as we have here the unrighteous and careless, that is, uncaring shepherds that are talked about in that chapter. And though he has trouble with the people, a lot of his trouble, his greatest difficulties are with the leaders of the people. And that's the way it was when Jesus came. And we'll read some passages about that when we get down to chapter 11. Okay, so just starting off here with chapter 10 here, God says, I will bless you with these good things. Don't trust in the idols. And then we'll catch the rest of this passage or this chapter next week and get on, which won't take very long, and get on in chapter 11, which will take a little longer to go through some of the points that are made there. Okay, any questions or more questions this morning? Appreciate the help with the history, guys. Not my strong point when it comes to secular history. Thank you.